My name is Julian Chambliss. It's February 10th, 2021. I'm here with Dr. Tanisha Taylor. We're doing an interview for Voices of the Black Imaginary, which is an oral history project about contemporary Afrofuturism that's housed in the Vincent Boyce Library at the Michigan State University Library. Tanisha, can you say your name for me?
Sure. So my name is Tanisha Latrice Taylor. You have to say the whole one when you're named after family, man.
And can you give us your title?
I am an associate professor of communication and the department chair for the Communication Studies Department at Texas Southern University.
Do I have your permission to record this conversation for the Vincent Boyce Library collection, Voices of the Black Imaginary? And can we use this recording in part or in whole in the podcast called Every Tongue's Got to Confess, the podcast of the Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities?
Of course.
Thank you. So this recording is going to be a part of a collection that is looking at Afrofuturism. As you were one of the keynote scholars at the 2021 Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities, because you talked about the theme of sound and Afrofuturism, I wanted to talk to you about your scholarship and about your thinking related to sound. So my first question is a relatively simple question, but I also know it's a hard question. But I think it's important, especially in the context of trying to define what is a dynamic thought movement. How do you define Afrofuturism?
Oh, wow. So I define Afrofuturism as, let me turn that off. My apologies. I define Afrofuturism as, it is hard. It's hard and it's complicated. So as a movement, I really define it as something that looks at the way that Black folks exist and build worlds for ourselves in both a sort of a tangible future. So the way that we will actually exist in the future on the planet, right? But also the way that we build and exist in worlds that are built by and for us in a speculative, imaginative future. And what I mean by that is like in music, in art, in stories, in fiction, in film, in television, what are the worlds that are the imagined that we build? And what do we look like in those spaces? And what do we do and how do we function? And how do we sound like? Like, what do people sound like? And so that's really sort of what how I define Afrofuturism. And in terms of the sound, I define it as a sound that should be more diverse than it was in the past, right? I think if you look at sort of what people thought was gonna be the future, right? So like Star Trek is a great example, right? All the Black people sounded the same and they all awkwardly sounded like they were from the Midwest somewhere. Like they all sounded like they were from Chicago. And so I think that, and what I hope is that now from this moment forward, that we start to recognize the diversity of Blackness and the diversity of Black Americanness, right? We're not a monolith and we never have been. And we shouldn't sound like one either, right? We should sound like we're from different places, like we're from different regions. So sometimes people should sound Southern and sometimes people should sound like they're from New York and sometimes people should sound like they're from the West Coast. And we should honor the difference that that makes because it means that we allow ourselves an existence in the future that is much more whole and much more authentic, I think, than what we've allowed for ourselves in the past.
I really appreciate your answer there. And as a communications scholar, I think your answer sort of indicates a concern about Black cultural practice as articulated through communication, which of course dovetails very strongly with Zora Neale Hurston and her contributions as a theorist and scholar. So when you think about your work as a communication scholar and this broader question of Black speculative practice, where is it that you think the contributions are being added to in the context of Afrofuturism? Is it in theory? Is it in practice? Is it a mix of the two?
I think it's a mix of the two, both in theory and practice. I think that in theory, though, for too long, I know Rinaldo Anderson and I have had this conversation a lot more over the last couple of years, that there are not enough communication scholars participating in Afrofuturism and Black speculative theory building. And part of that is, you know, kind of those of us who are kind of probably need to holler back to our friends and get them more involved. But also, you know, it's theory building isn't for the weak. I'll call on, right? No, seriously. I'll call on a mentor professor of mine, Dr. Marquita Bird, who is my professor at San Jose State. And she said something, she actually said that, which I found incredibly profound when I was working on my master's degree, right? Is that theory building is not for the weak and it's not for everyone. Lots of people can talk about theory. Lots of people can apply theory to analyze something. Some people can analyze theory, very few people can build theory, right? And very few people, even fewer people can build theory that can be practically used by the everyday person, right? Like that takes a very special level. And so the thing that I think is important though about Afrofuturism is the theorists like Rinaldo who are involved in it are involved in the theory building, I find that the best ones are always thinking about the practical, right? They're always thinking about how is a regular everyday Black person gonna use this theory to help them build and do in their everyday practical life, right? Which goes back to Zora Neale Hurston. Her theory building was very much about the practical, right? It was very much about how are people gonna use this to make their own actual life better. Like she wasn't interested in building theory so that it would sit on a shelf at Columbia. Like that's not what her goal was in life, right? She wanted to build theory that would help regular everyday Black people understand spiritual life better, right? Regular everyday Black people practice, right, their spiritual lives more fully and completely, right? And see that as an authentic thing that they're allowed to do in the world or, you know, to organize, you know, their community so that they weren't overpleased, right? And these were just regular things that she saw that people needed a way to explain it, right? And so theory also, and this is something I tell my students, theory is just a way to explain a thing, but it's also a way to analyze a thing. And so when we're building theory, I think the best theories to me are the ones that allow regular people to be able to explain their regular life in regular language, right? And I think that's how you know you got something that works, right? That has a practical place. And I think that's what I'm always looking for, especially like for all theory in general, but for Afrocentric and Afrofuturist theories in particular. If they can't be used by regular Black people to explain everyday Black life, then it's not useful. It's not practical.
So that's a really important point. And I agree with you that one of the things about Afrofuturism, especially as a contemporary movement, that it does seem to intersect very strongly with things that are happening on the ground. And this idea that Afrofuturism as a term is connected to what what scholars like Rinaldo Anson would talk about as Black speculative practice, which has a longer tradition than that term that we call Afrofuturism, really gets into why the practices of a past figure like Zora Neale Hurston or any number of other past figures become very much a part of like this contemporary movement. And so to that end, you know, when you talk about Afrofuturism and sound, and you recognize a person like Zora Neale Hurston as a part of that tradition, what do you tell people in terms of contextualizing the work of sound in the lives of the Black people and their experience in the past as a contemporary thing? And as you say, I was pointing to a more diverse future, right? Because already you sort of alluded to the fact that sound is a marker of diversity that we don't take into account in the way that we do other things. And for the future to be truly free, I may be projecting too much here, but for the future to be truly free, perhaps a greater understanding of the abundance of the different types of sounds are required. And the question immediately becomes, well, how do you get there?
Right, right. I think, so yes. for me, I don't think you're projecting too much on that idea of freedom. I see that is intimately connected to our ability to be fully Black, right? And a lot of that has to do with my positionality. I am a second generation Black woman Californian. Both of my parents were born in California. I was born in California. My grandparents, my mother's parents came from Arkansas. My father's parents came from Georgia and Tennessee. Well, actually Alabama and Tennessee. And they moved during World War II, like a lot of folks. They moved to Northern California. Both of my grandfathers were in the Army. And when the war was over, one grandfather stayed in the Army and had a much longer career, became an officer and all that. And the other one left and did other kind of work. Always worked in sort of management jobs as much as you could as a Black man, right, on the West Coast, right? And so it means that I sound the way I sound because I grew up where I grew up, right? And so a lot of times as a kid, but also even since less as an adult now, thank God, but certainly as a kid, I got teased a lot for not sounding Black, right? Because an authentic Black sound is always either a New York kind of Blackness or Southern, more specifically a Southern Blackness, right? But I didn't know anything about either one of those things, right? My family is not East Coast. They're definitely, their roots are in the South, but they had left so long ago that this is what they sounded like, right? But also on top of that, on my father's side of the family, they actually had a decent amount of education as well. So they didn't have sort of that Southern Black twang that they didn't sound like everybody else that I knew that sounded a certain kind of Southernness, right? But even that Southernness is highly diverse because if you listen to Black Southerners from Texas, they don't sound the same as people from Louisiana, who don't sound the same as people from Georgia, but who don't even sound the same as people from Florida. But when you look at the sort of longer history, particularly related to music, when we're talking about jazz and blues, a lot of those Black Southerners are coming out of Florida, Louisiana, Texas, and Georgia. And that is the Black sound that's elevated. My family's from Arkansas, right? My mom's family's from Arkansas. Like I said, my dad's family is from Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia. They don't sound the same, right? So you end up with this very particular sound that becomes generational, right? And that's one of the things that we don't understand or we don't talk about enough is that accents are regional, but they're also generational, right? You learn how to talk from the people that talk to you. You develop your sound from the sound that you hear around you. And so if everyone that talks to you sounds like I sound right now, then that's the sound you're going to develop. And if that's all the Black people you see, your assumption is that this is an authentic Black sound. I think what we have done to ourselves as Black people that has also been detrimental to some extent is we have allowed sort of a previous white practice in media to say that Black people can only sound this narrowly, right? And this is an authentic Blackness and all these other things outside of it, you know, which might go for all these other regions, all these other classes, even all these other educational levels, those don't count. And we end up discounting a lot of that. I think what I really love about Zora Neale Hurston, though, especially if you look at her interviews where she recorded people from all different regions with all different accents and all different dialects. And if we really listen to what she did, even what Oscar Michaud did as a filmmaker, you see Blackness in this very rich diversity where it sounds different from all of these different regions and all of these different people. And I think what we need to start doing as a community, and what I definitely do when I talk to people is say, because I still occasionally, not often, but I will occasionally have students who will say, is that what your whole family sounds like, right? And I say to them, yes, this is what my whole family sounds like. We're all born in California. This is what Black Californians sound like. But specifically Black Northern Californians, because Black Northern Californians, if you look at sort of that great migration line, tended to come from the Upper South, right? And so this is what people kind of sound like if they're migrating through the Upper South and the Midwest. If you're migrating through the Lower South, coming down the 10, right? The 10 goes from Santa Monica all the way out to Atlanta, right? And so you're gonna catch that swath, right? And they sound different, right? So that's why Black folks in LA sound different, but Black folks in San Jose, San Francisco, Oakland, they sound different too. And a lot of it is about that sort of mix of locations where people are coming from, whether they're coming from the Lower South or the Upper South, and then moving west. It happens, we're actually seeing it now happening in the reverse, right? Where all those folks from California are moving back to the South, or they're moving to the Midwest, or they're moving to the East Coast, or they're moving to the Southeast. And we're starting to see that sort of, that sound of Blackness is kind of shifting a lot more now. I think part of that is also because of social media as well. And so we're seeing a lot more diversity of Black folks just speaking, right? And they're not speaking with some particularized diction or particularized accent that they learned in a voice and diction class back when that used to be something that everybody was forced to take. And so people we're seeing a lot more diversity in Black sound because of that. I think we're actually seeing a lot more diversity in everybody's sound because of that, because people aren't taking elocution classes in high school anymore. Thank God.
Well, I really appreciate your answer, in part because it speaks to an idea of a critical geography around sound and Blackness that I think we can map over not just simply the United States, but you did so eloquently in terms of the United States, but you know, also becomes part of a kind of global concern about Blackness. Yeah. When you think about, you know, as a communication scholar and this question of like sound as a global practice, one of the things that seems that you're alluding to is a necessity for us to sort of recognize both the evolution of sound that happens through movement, but also a kind of generational aspect, and then a kind of rootedness and a set of consequences related to particular places that now in our contemporary moment is globalized. And I think this is one of the things that a lot of Afrofuturists put a lot of stock in, the fact that it's a global movement. But at the same time, as you, I think, are sort of hinting at, the nature of that globalism doesn't exclude the particularities of like a particular place, right? And so as a sound scholar, when you think about the relationship between this sort of global narrative of Blackness versus these local narrative of Blackness, what's the benefit in terms of these frameworks for us in terms of trying to understand the Black experience? Is it just giving us a sense of these are the things that we have ignored in the past, and we should have a more equitable sense of the diversity here? What's at stake in these questions of locality versus globalism, and when it comes to sound and culture?
For me, what's at stake is, I think, the same thing that was at stake for Zora Neale Hurston. It's an authentic Blackness, right? I want all Black folks across the entire diaspora to see themselves as authentically present and valued with an equitable place of existence. And so that to me is the biggest thing at stake, especially because even though, like I said, I don't get picked on anymore for the way that I sound, when I travel internationally, remember when outside was open and people were allowed to go places? I know. But if you can remember back that far, when we had passports and we actively went places, whenever I would leave the country, and I don't care where I went, whether I went to the Caribbean or I went, you know, around different places throughout Europe or, you know, to Mexico or Canada, right? Or the Pacific Islands, everyone asked me where I was from, right? Everyone. No one assumed I was American, ever, right? And one of the things that, I mean, I remember standing in Paris and actually having somebody tell me I was lying to them because my French ain't great, but apparently it's good enough that they were like, no, 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 no. You can't possibly be an American citizen. And the person actually said to me, first of all, mademoiselle, you're too pretty and you're too smart. And I was like, what? What have we been showing people about Americans, right? And he was just like, no, no, no. And so he just swore I had to have been from the Caribbean somewhere with a French Caribbean grandmother because I just didn't sound American to him. And it wasn't that I didn't sound Black. To him, he was like, no, you don't sound American. Like, that's not what Americans sound like, right? And that's because media, right? Like I said, for years, people took elocution classes, you took voice and diction classes. If you were trained to be a broadcaster, right? For years, the accepted notion was that the best of the American accents for broadcasting, for acting even, was a Midwestern accent, which is very particular elocution, very particular sound. I don't have that either. And so people just naturally assume that I have to be from someplace else because I don't sound American. They don't tell me I don't sound Black. They tell me I don't sound American. They assume that I because to them, what they hear in my sound is a Blackness that's not American, but it's still Black to them. So they still read me that way in my sound, but they don't read me as American, which is very interesting because I never have. I think part of it is because growing up in the Bay Area is a very international place. And so I know and knew all kinds of Black people and all kinds of brown people from all kinds of places. And so I think that's part of it. But I also think that, you know, it also comes out of my sort of natural curiosity about the world and wanting to see also a Black, an authentic Blackness that doesn't sound the same, right? Because for, at this point now, decades, I've been saying Blackness is not a monolith. It's not the same everywhere. It doesn't look the same from everyone, that you have to take into account throughout the United States region and history, right? Because the the country didn't develop the same way everywhere at the same time, right? So you have to take into account what that looks like and what that sounds like and what that becomes and how it crosses over Black and brown bodies in very specific ways that is not the same everywhere, right? But then throughout the world is the same thing, right? A lot of Blackness is kind of about the impact of colonialism. And what that how that impact was felt on Black people, right? And it's not all slavery either, right? But it is all capitalism, it is all colonialism. And so what I wanna see, and I think what's important to me as a communication scholar, is to always see and hear and understand the value in how those things manifest and what they do differently to our sound and the way that we present, right? So I'm also really interested in like sartorial rhetoric as well, right? So like the rhetoric of clothing choices, of jewelry choices, of hair choices, because all of those things say something, they communicate something about you, you know? I think more, I was talking with some colleagues and I was like, you know, one of the things that somebody is gonna end up writing about is, you know, Zoom, because of technology, right? Zoom calls. We're seeing, especially, and something we're gonna be able to analyze, right, is a comparison of backgrounds and decor background choices between Black presenters on news and white presenters on news, right? And Latino presenters and Asian presenters, but also an international comparison between like what the BBC allowed and what US news allowed, right? In terms of the backgrounds of presenters, right? Who were presenting a news, right? And the difference between sort of national news and local news, between journalists and commentators, right? Because there are different choices. And I think that we see it, we got to see it for the first time because not everybody's in the studio with the same one background, but also we got to see it for the first time and hear it for the first time in the way that people talk, because when you're at home, there's a certain level of comfort that, so there's less, to some degree, you end up putting less effort on kind of creating this falsetto in your voice, right? And so it just kind of comes out the way it comes out. Now, for some folks, that was happening regardless. But in the studio, where you have a sound mixer who can do a live sound mixing and can set a mic at a certain pitch and, you know, set it at a certain volume and things like that, your voice might have sounded different because it was being mixed differently live. Lag time of a video recording of a feed coming into a studio means that you're not going to do that as much. And so I think that one of the things that we'll see for Black folks is that we're going to see a lot more, we have seen already a lot more authenticity in what people actually sound like, right? Because you're not having that live mixing and live editing of audio in the same way. And what that means for us in terms of diversity is that we're hearing ourselves for the first time.
You know, following up on that, I think one of the things that's always interesting in the context of these conversations is that for scholars in particular, or something like Afrofuturism, they're always in, pardon the pun, communication with the canon. Mm-hmm. And the challenge there, of course, for the sort of general audience, the canon in a particular discipline are the works that define how the discipline is, for a basic definition. Mm-hmm. And Afrofuturism tends to be at the leading edge, the bleeding edge, as I sometimes say, in terms of thinking about that, in terms of canon. So for you as a sound communication scholar, how do you see Afrofuturism interceding or changing the canon? Is it just simply a question of diversity? Is it a question of the spaces that we might consider in terms of shaping sound and rhetorics of communication. How do you place it in that complicated exercise?
I see it as diversity and equity. I see that there is, because for me, diversity is important, but equity matters. So it doesn't matter if you have a diverse set of options, if there's no equity in the way that those options can be accessed or exercised, right? You know, we have lots of, and I this really came home during this summer, during the protests related to the death of George Floyd, right? Where people were talking about how, if you look at it in terms of diversity, you had diversity in the cops that killed him, right? Because there was some everybody in that group. But what you still don't have is equity, right? You don't have equity in his right to live. Like, they still didn't see that. And so that's for me, we need both. So I want to see and I want to hear the diversity of Black folks talking, Black folks theorizing, Black folks sort of explaining and understanding the world and living the world. But I also want equity that says each one of these things has value and has a right to exist, right? I think that one of the things that I actually have to go back and read that piece again because I think it got edited out. It's something I always wanted to be there, but I'm almost positive it got edited out. So I wrote this piece years ago about Tyler Perry, and it was called Woman Thou Art Produced, about sort of Tyler Perry's lack of womanist characters and characterizations in his plays, right? And one of the things that I wanted to kind of drive home in that piece is that we need the diversity of Tyler Perry, right? Tyler Perry needs to exist as a filmmaker. I don't have to watch any of it though. And you can't snatch my Black card because I tell you, A, I'm not gonna watch it, and B, I don't like it, right? We have to have that diversity of possibility, because the kind of stories that Tyler Perry tells about Blackness are not, they don't appeal to me. It's actually not really an experience I can really, it doesn't track with what I understand my experience of Blackness to be, right? And as Black folks, we've got to stop with this idea that we have to have this monolith, right? I think that's sometimes the problem with the canon. Canons naturally push toward a monolith, right? They push to an authoritative understanding, right? If you say that something has a canon or that a particular author is a member of a canon, what you're saying is this is, like you said, what we're saying is this is the sort of boundary of the discipline, right? And that's fine. As long as we allow for an authentic growth of that canon, right? Canons cannot be static. I think that's the thing that Afrofuturism really pushes on, is this idea that yes, we can have a canon, but the canon for Afrofuturism from the 90s is not the canon of Afrofuturism for 2021, right? And I think, Natrice Gaskin mentions this or writes about this, that you can't, if you're not doing that, if you're not growing as the canon grows, then you're not doing Afrofuturism anymore, right? You're doing Black rhetoric, right? Which she didn't say that, but I would say if you're looking at the Afrofuturism canon from the 90s, you're not doing Afrofuturism. You're doing Black rhetoric now, right? And that's fine, and that's important, and that's valuable, but that's because the canon has moved, right? Which is different than, I think, English or history, or other kind of disciplines, even to some extent communication, where the canon moves more slowly. And, you know, what is sort of the established canon might stay around for, you know, 25, 50, even 100 years. And it doesn't, you know, it progresses, but it progresses at a slower clip. And so an Afrofuturism, by nature of sort of the specificity of its own design, is not designed to be a slow moving canon. It's designed to be a fast moving, futuristic, always on, always sort of the future past, right? It's always that space. And that's what it's designed on purpose to do. And so I think that it means that as a scholar, if this is the area you want to do your scholarship in, you have to stretch, right? You have to be more limber to do this work, because you have to be staying with it, right? It's not like doing, which I have a couple of professors who would be mad that I say this, and they've asked me to stop, and I have not, and I never will. So you should all just accept it, right? You can do old dead white guy rhetoric. You don't have to stretch to do that. I don't care who you are. You don't have to stretch to do that, right? Because you're talking about a canon that is literally 2,000 years old. If you're talking about, and this is why I don't teach it either, right? If you're talking about doing Aristotelian or even neo-Aristotelian rhetoric, you're talking about doing work based on work that is 2,000 years old. You don't need to stretch, right? You barely need to breathe, in my opinion. It doesn't take much, right? Because it's been such a long part of the canon. Now, do I think that we should get rid of that canon? No, absolutely not. It definitely needs to be there. It has a space and a place, because that canon is the canon that actually guides American small d, small r, democracy and republicanism, right? So you need to that canon, you need to keep it, you need to understand it, because through that canon, you can understand how you incite a riot, right? How do you incite an insurrection? Go back and read Plato and Aristotle, it's incredibly clear, right? Because it's based on the three particulars of rhetoric. And that's it, right? But you need to understanding that canon is gonna help you understand that moment. But understanding Du Bois, understanding the canon, even the sort of the canon of the Harlem Renaissance, is gonna help you understand last summer, right? And the particularities of BLM, of the BLM movement, of Black Lives Matter movement, right? Understanding Huey Newton and the particularities of the Black Panther movement, of SNCC. These things are, and that sort of specifically that African-American rhetorical tradition is gonna make that moment make sense, right? Understanding the connection between Du Bois and how he wrote about the Red Summer in 1919 will help you understand how people are writing about the summer of 2019, right? Understanding what was happening in the Black community during the influenza pandemic is gonna help you understand how people are communicating about the current COVID-19 pandemic. Understanding people's hesitancy around vaccine, you need to go back and look at how people were treated and how vaccine was communicated to people in Black communities during the polio epidemic. But if you look at the canon of Aristotle, that actually will help you understand why white people were persuaded to take a vaccine for influenza and polio in the early part of the 20th century. It'll also help you understand why Black people were not, right? And so, but what will help you understand what helped Black people make that move is if you look at the talented 10th, and the rhetoric of the talented 10th will help you understand why certain Black people are not hesitant to vaccine, or why certain other Black people still are, right? And so for me, I look at sort of how all of that allows us to frame communication moments, and particularly then how Afrofuturism helps us to break through in that kind of fluidity of the past future and the future past, right? And really break through sort of where a canon goes and how a canon functions. Because I think it's also, it does not matter what a canon is or who's in the canon or what readings are in the canon if nobody's using it, right? It honestly doesn't matter. And the only reason why you have a canon is so that you have something to use, right? You have theory and method to use. You have literature to use. And so it's about use. It's about equity. It's about diversity. It's about also, like I said, it's about, to me, understanding like that some parts of the canon are useful for certain things. And a canon has never been all things to all people.
I like that. And I think that's a good place to end it. Thank you so much for taking the time to answer my questions.
You're welcome.
And thank you for your work. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to have this conversation. One of the things I am hoping is, like I said in my talk, is that we'll actually see Zora Neale Hurston in more of the canon. Now that I've said that, right, and more of the canon that's used really to explain the way that we understand how Black folks sound and how Black folks act and what is sort of rhetorically available, right? So I hope we'll see more of that for communication.
Awesome.
Yeah.